Well, I think most of you know me. I'm Nancy Welch, and I'm going to talk about three precepts tonight that are all very interrelated, and those are precepts 4, 6, and 7. The precept of not lying, or another way of saying it is a disciple of Buddha is truthful and does not lie. Precept 6 is not discussing the faults of others. A disciple of Buddha sees goodness, does not slander. And precept 7 is not praising oneself while abusing others, or a disciple of Buddha is modest and does not praise self nor disparage others. And so you can probably see how those interrelate. And I'm going to start with a poem that I wrote about these things. And it is called Right Speech, Right Words. I want to write so many words for things that I've seen and done and felt. Too many words. What if they're not the right words? With the intention to write comes expectations. With the expectations to write comes the need to be read. And need asks questions. Is it good? Will others like my words? Will the words be read, be understood? Will praise for my words take away these fears? Or will these words, my words, appear foolish, be foolish? How will I bear that shame? Paralyzed, perhaps it is better not even to begin. From a quiet place, I hear my teacher's voice. Who is this one holding the pen? And with that, the words are free to fall upon the page. I want to write so many words for things I have seen and done and felt. Too many words. What if they're not the right words? With the intention to write comes expectation. With expectations to write comes the need to be read. And the need asks questions, is it good? Will others like my words? Will the words be read, be understood? Will praise for my words take away these fears? Or will the words, my words, appear foolish, be foolish? How will I bear that shame? Paralyzed, perhaps it is better not even to start. From a quiet place, I hear my teacher's voice. Who is this one holding the pen? And with that, the words are free to fall upon the page. A disciple of Buddha is truthful, does not lie. I work with kids a lot. It's amazing to watch them discover lying. There's a certain age when they don't know they can do that. They figure mom and dad know everything. And when they discover they can lie, it's quite amazing sometimes. And there's a lot of reasons that we learn and may choose to lie. Let's go through them. We want to avoid responsibility, avoid blame, punishment for something we've done that's wrong. Or perhaps we want to please others. We want them to like us, and we want to feel like we belong. So we tell them what they want to hear. Perhaps we want to manipulate others to get what we want from them. Again, telling them what they want to hear. Or perhaps we just need the reassurance that we know, we are in the know, we are in control. And that is a credible self-deception, that one is in control of very much. There are also lies that are not necessarily unskillful or harmful, and those would be the lies to protect ourselves and others, such as the many people did during World War II, protecting Jewish children and Jewish families and other minorities that were being oppressed. Also, at times, we want to avoid giving pain to others. Sometimes we call those little white lies. Do I look fat in this dress? Oh, honey, you never look fat. You know, little white lies that sometimes are sweet, but they're still lies. And they can lead to other delusions, if you think about it. And of course, lying to avoid conflict. That's a big one, I think. Especially for women in this culture, I would say. Not to be sexist, but I've just heard so many women say in my work with people, I hate conflict. I'll do anything to not get into it. And that often means manipulating your words, not being very truthful so that there's no friction. And it is so easy to do. Little lies are so slippery. And I saw an example in myself just a couple weeks ago. Tim mentioned he had thoughts of stealing last week and resisted. I didn't even think about lying, I just did it. I was at a movie with a child and the ticket taker said, one child and one senior. And I said, yes. I may look like a senior, but technically, I still have 10 years to go. And I just did it seamlessly. It's like, oh, I can get a couple bucks off. It went like that. Just, I did it. Pretty profound consequences for some lies. I think the worst is it causes confusion in others. And it fosters insecurity and mistrust. If one doesn't know whether you're telling the truth or not, and the lies keep coming and they get more and more confusing, that causes deep distress for the people who are being lied to and don't know what to believe. It also is very harmful in terms of self-deception. Through lying, we are creating a false reality, avoiding the present moment, and trying to paint this reality that we want to be in and want other people to see us in. If one lies to avoid conflicts, those conflicts just don't go away. The unresolved conflicts tend to simmer and simmer and simmer, and sometimes eventually blow. I think a constant consequence of that withholding in order to avoid conflict is the creating and the holding of grudges. You keep wanting to give in and get along and get along, and pretty soon you find that your feelings towards this person or these people that you're trying to get along with aren't so pleasant. Lying, as these other precepts about speech will also show, I think one of the worst things it does is it creates and maintains separation from others. If you're not being truthful, you're not really being connected with one another. You've put a lie, you've put a barrier. You've put something you do not want them to find out between you. And so there is no wholeness, no oneness. And there's also, in a similar way, you put a barrier between being your true self. If you've set up a lie or a series of lies about who you are or what you want or what you're doing, and you have to maintain that, it begins to twist how you see yourself, twist that reality. Lies can protect others from harm, as mentioned earlier. That is a good consequence in war and in other situations where you're protecting others from harm. And another interesting consequence of believing a lie or believing that you have found the absolute truth is that then once you believe what you have said or what you have thought and then said and then started elaborating and embroidering, and suddenly you've got dogma. And in this book, Waking Up to What You Do, by Diane Rossetto, she has a great example, a little conversation between I think a monk and Mara. Just a moment, here it is. One day Mara was traveling along the road with some of his attendants and noticed a man doing walking meditation. The man's face glowed with delight. It seems he had just discovered something on the ground in front of him. Noticing the glow lighting the man's face, one of Mara's attendants asked the god what the man had discovered. And Mara answered, "It seems he has discovered a piece of truth." His attendant grew quite excited and exclaimed, "But you're the god of deception. Aren't you bothered by that fact that someone has just found a piece of truth?" And Mara answered, "I'm not troubled in the least." "But why?" asked the attendant. "Because," Mara replied, chuckling, "no sooner do people discover a little truth than they make a belief out of it." And then you get dogma, and then you get intransience, which is very harmful, very non-growth producing. There are other lies besides outright lies, like, "No, Mom, I didn't get in your purse." You know. There are lies of silence. And again, sometimes that can serve a life-enhancing purpose when you are silent in order to prevent harm from another. But most often, lies of silence imply complicity in someone else's harmful choice. You might think that you're protecting someone that you care from exposure or harm. But what that does is then it initiates an inner defensiveness, which then must continue deepening and justifying your self-deception. So lies of silence can really eat away at one's soul, because you will need to continue to justify it until you can break free of it. The sixth precept, disciple of Buddha sees goodness, does not slander. Again, a lot to do with speech. And there are, again, many reasons we find and justify to speak ill of each other, especially politicians, for me. One big reason is revenge. When we feel hurt by one another, we want to even the score. And in order to do that, saying ill things, unskillful things, cruel things about them, can sometimes then make our hurt feel a little better somehow. Again, we might also choose to gossip or speak ill of one to act as if we are in the know. We're in the group, we're special, we're in the in-group. We feel, we do it to feel that we belong to a certain group that we hold above others and then exclude those others so we can feel more special. And this, it creates a false sense of intimacy in that in-group. If you ever read the Secret Sharer by Joseph Conrad. Secrets can be poison. And thinking that, well, we are the ones who are in the know and we won't share with others can be very destructive in so many ways. And of course, when there is abuse or real crime going on, and especially against a child, and they are told, this is our secret, and if you tell, bad things will happen. That is a real soul killer to a child. And of course, to the person who is telling that and doing whatever it is they're doing to that child. And the consequences of slander, of not promoting and seeing goodness in others, is again, I think the strongest consequence is the creation of separateness and disharmony between others. We sow seeds of doubt and suspicion and encourage mistrust when we say they are bad and we are good, or she's a jerk and I know better. The intimacy, as I said, between secret sharers is a false intimacy because it's based on rejecting another or others rather than accepting each other and joining each other. It also implies an unchangeability or a constancy of character, which actually is a caricature. If you're convinced that so-and-so is just incurable gossip, they will always be an incurable gossip to you. They become a caricature rather than seeing them as a dynamic, multifaceted human being that we all are, with the potential for change and the potential to have other facets besides being an incorrigible gossip. It also nurtures dehumanization, which in the extreme provides justification for outrages such as genocide. If we can separate and make the other truly other and not us, then you can keep going and going and going until they're no longer worthy of life because they're so different from us. And in slander, there is also a complicity of silence that can happen. There's one of the few Latin things I remember from my Catholic education is actually often used in law and in organizations, and that is, probably not pronouncing this right after many years, but it's qui tacat consentire videtur, which means silence implies consent. It is used in Robert's Rules of Order, which is a standard organized way of holding meetings and coming to decisions. That's a very widespread in Western culture. It's also a policy that's adopted in the Organization of European States and NATO. So if one does not speak out, it is assumed you consent to whatever's happening. This really demonstrates the power of silence, I think. And back on an individual level, listening to gossip without speaking up or leaving the scene can be just as harmful to yourself and others as if you were being the slanderer yourself. And again, I have another great example in my life just recently. I was just chatting away with a friend who suddenly said, very kindly and gently, reminding me of this precept by saying, should I really be hearing this? Because I was talking about someone who wasn't there. And it was a beautiful, gentle way to bring me back to, yeah, I see what I'm doing now. So there are skillful ways to help people with these problems. And of course, the seventh precept, a disciple of Buddha, is modest and does not praise self at the expense of or disparagement of others. And I would like to I think this is a very subtle one. So when Robert Aiken quotes Bodhidharma as saying, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the equitable Dharma, not dwelling upon I against you is called the precept of not praising yourself while abusing others. It can be one of the most subtle ways of harming others through comparison. Whether good or bad, it separates us, highlights the differences, and divides us from one another. And it often involves drawing attention to ourselves, wanting to be seen as special, sometimes as the best at something, and sometimes as the worst. My teacher Norman, we often used to laugh at how I would try to paint myself as the absolute worst practicing Buddhist in the world. I mean, I was so bad, I was above everybody else in it. And it's just, I might as well have said I'm the best Buddhist because I was trying to push everyone else away and separate myself. Self-praise or any action or speech meant to draw attention to oneself, even if it's not criticizing others, is certainly immodest. Although, I often think of the little children who want so badly to be seen sometimes when they are in a family system that doesn't tend to really see them. And you'll hear them, Mommy, Mommy, look at me. Daddy, look, look, look. And, you know, Daddy will be reading the paper, or Mom will keep talking to her friend. And it's kind of sad because a child does need to be seen. And once they feel seen, they don't need to grasp at it. They don't need to keep trying for it. Another way of acting out in this precept in a negative way is through energy sucking. And there are those of us who often do that. We suck energy from other people by consistently playing the clown, wanting laughter, wanting attention, teasing the teacher, wanting to be seen as the smart aleck, the cute little smart aleck, or holding forth in high dudgeon, which I'm very good at, which truly serves only my ego. And again, as was pointed out to me, again, lovingly and gently, it leaves no room for others to engage with me. I get on a rant and there's no room. You sit and listen. That's it. That's what you're there for, which is very negating of that person's individuality and thoughts. Depending on how many people you're holding captive with your rant or your jokes or your know-it-all observations, you can do a lot of harm, and make people feel very alienated from you, and you're alienating yourself. Subtle criticisms are slippery. How many of us have had the experience in which our parents or teachers sometimes took the pencil right out of our hand, or the dish we were washing, or the broom we were trying to sweep with, took it right out of our hands and said, just let me do it, it'll be easier. What does that say? What does that say to that kid? Or the adult? Sometimes we do it to our friends, we do it to our spouses as well. We are taught how to behave sometimes through shame. I call this parenting by shame. Example, a child spills the milk and immediately, you clumsy, you idiot, you know better than that. Now, how helpful is that? Instead of hearing, it's a mistake, what do we need to do to clean it up? Which, there's no shame, there's no distancing that person from yourself as different, stupid, inferior. And yet, so many people, and I remember my father discovering this in family therapy, he parented by shame, and he felt so ashamed when he realized that. He thought that once you embarrassed your child, they would never do it again, not realizing the scar it would leave over time. Praising ourselves and criticizing others is one of the more obvious ways to demonstrate the power of attachment. Just as putting ourselves down as less than everyone else also shows attachment to specialness. There is such a hunger to be seen as different, as special, as outside the realm. And this precept easily intersects with number 6. I mean, how else best to puff ourselves up than by saying or thinking, thank God that's not me, even if you don't say it out loud to the person. And there's an example from the Bible. I remember clearly that in the temple, there's a publican or, you know, middle-class person, and there's a beggar, and they are each giving what they can to support the temple. But the richer man sees the shabby robes of the poor man and the little shekel he can give. And the man thanks God that he has been given the gift of having more to give and that somehow he's better than. And he's happy to give more, not out of generosity, but out of pride. So to summarize these intersection of these three incredibly powerful precepts. And I noticed I've given this is the fourth talk I've given on this throughout the years. There's something that keeps drawing me back to these precepts about speech. As I went through all my notes, it's like, well, I gave that in 203 and 206. And I guess it's something I need to keep learning. The skills to practice again and again to work with these precepts is that of mindfulness, of constantly, as best we can, observing our own behavior and how it leads us to feel, and being willing to listen to others when they tell us how our behavior has affected them. Such as my friend saying, there's no room for me to say anything, you know, you're holding forth here. You know, what can I do? Being willing to listen, take the feedback, but without defensiveness or pretending to take it in and then hold a grudge against them for the rest of your life for pointing it out that you were wrong. Somewhere I read or was told, this kind of sums it up. Oh, almost on time. The best thing to do before one speaks or passes judgment or jumps into the gossip pool is to ask yourself these three questions. Is what I am thinking or about to say true? Is it necessary that I say it? And if it is true and necessary, is it kind and life encouraging? And although we are not in control of what others think of us or how they will take in our words, are we truly using the most nurturing language? This is another question you can ask yourself if you must say something necessary and true. What is the most nurturing, life-enhancing language we can frame it in? And can we sit still for a moment in what Rosetto refers to as the dead spot? Which sounds kind of creepy, but it's the quiet spot where you think a moment. Something's been said, a thought's been provoked, you can just blurt out whatever it is that's come to mind, or you can just sit still in that spot for a moment before you speak and consider the three questions above. Thank you.